Hey, everybody. In this part two with Ed Sander on the Negotiation Podcast, we continue to explore the dynamic and rapidly evolving landscape of China's digital technology scene. We cover the adaptation of Alibaba and JD.com in the evolving e-commerce landscape. We go into an analysis of Alibaba's user-first strategy and its impact, insights into He Ma's role within Alibaba's ecosystem, Douyin's rise as a formidable e-commerce platform, the potential of Little Red Book as an e-commerce site, an overview of the competitive local services market in China, and emerging trends in China's digital space that are reshaping the industry. Enjoy.
Well, the interesting thing is that Taobao wasn't doing so well for a while. And one of the reasons was that a lot of the traffic that was generated for Taobao was diverted to Tmall. The whole idea behind this was that China was going through a consumption upgrade. So people would be looking for branded goods and more expensive luxury stuff instead of the white label stuff that they maybe used to buy on Taobao. It's also one of the reasons why a lot of merchants started selling their goods on Pinduoduo as well, because they didn't get as much traffic anymore. So this sort of created a bit of a crisis situation. And when we came out of COVID, currently the consumer isn't spending the way they did prior to COVID. So according to some people, what actually has been happening is a consumption downgrade. People, instead of having the expensive luxury stuff, they are buying more white label products that are just as good.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Ed, I wanted to pivot over to Alibaba and JD. How do these traditional, so funny to say that, traditional search-based marketplaces, how do these companies fit into China's evolving commerce landscape? If you could put them on the map for me a little bit.
Yeah, like you said, they're traditional. They're the two, basically the two first big e-commerce companies that appeared in China more than 20 years ago. Alibaba started out as a business-to-business platform, Alibaba.com, and later developed Taobao, which was more like a C2C platform, but also for small and medium enterprises. That became their big traffic generator in China. And they used some of that traffic to divert people to Tmall, which launched in 2008, which is much more about B2C branded goods. So to be able to sell on Tmall, you have to be an authorized reseller or you have to be the brand itself. So a big difference with JD.com is that JD did their or does their own logistics. So they have their own couriers, they have their own warehouses, where Alibaba didn't do that, although they now, of course, have a business division called Cainiao, which is also doing logistics, which used to be just a joint venture with a couple of logistical companies. Like you said, what they call this in China, this traditional search-based e-commerce, is shelf commerce, they call that now, as if you go into a store looking for something that you already know that you're going to buy, whereas something else that has developed both in Pinduoduo, but also in Douyin and Kuaishou, is what they call content-based e-commerce, which is much more about trying to figure out your preferences. For instance, in Douyin, by what kind of content you look at. And I mean, we all know that in Douyin and TikTok, it has a great algorithm that can figure out what you want to look at and give you more of that same type of content. And that's why it's so addictive. If you can link that up with the same with products and already having this enormous reach as a video platform, you can also start serving people short videos about products or live commerce where certain products are being sold in. So that is content-based e-commerce, much more based on an algorithm. Now, what they often say is that shelf e-commerce is people looking for products, whereas content-based e-commerce or interest-based e-commerce is products looking for the right people, which is done through these algorithms. And they sort of sometimes overlap. So Alibaba at one point also realized, okay, we're just a search-based e-commerce platform, but people don't go to Taobao to have fun. So we need some kind of content and entertainment. And that's also one of the reasons why they were one of the first e-commerce platforms to launch live commerce. So people would actually spend more time on their platform. And even my wife, who's Chinese, she also watches these live streams, even though she doesn't buy anything, but she's just entertained by watching these live streamers. So you currently have like sort of two different types of e-commerce, the interest-based and the shelf e-commerce that have sort of also started to overlap.
To put it in maybe more of a European context, it's like watching Graham Norton show. And yet the whole time there, you know, there's stuff that can be purchased. You're there for the entertainment, but then, I love, you know, what Sandra Bullock, I love her shoes. I want to buy those. And so you buy them while watching this, you know, talk show or something like that. But yeah, that's kind of the entertainment based model, which adds time on app, obviously, for a lot of users. And then for anybody in marketing knows, if you're trying to sell advertising, then now you need these types of metrics and you need them to be as high as possible. And because you have to be very competitive to what others are being able to say about the users and the audience and time on map and things like that as well. And you package all that data into a proposition to try to sell advertising on your platform as well. Another way to make money, you know, the freemium model, all that kind of stuff. However, as usual, I digress. Let's talk a little bit about Taobao and Tmall specifically, because they've seemed to have a good year to date with their user first strategy. Tell us a little bit about that and how well they've done.
Well, the interesting thing is that Taobao wasn't doing so well for a while. And one of the reasons was that a lot of the traffic that was generated for Taobao was diverted to Tmall. The whole idea behind this was that China was going through a consumption upgrade. So people would be looking for branded goods and more expensive luxury stuff instead of the white label stuff that they maybe used to buy on Taobao. It's also one of the reasons why a lot of merchants started selling their goods on Pinduoduo as well, because they didn't get as much traffic anymore on Taobao. So this sort of created a bit of a crisis situation. And when we came out of COVID, and currently the consumer isn't spending the way they did prior to COVID or even maybe during the first years of COVID. So according to some people, what actually has been happening is a consumption downgrade. People, instead of having the expensive luxury stuff, they are buying more white label products that are just as good. And that means that if you cannot really get that on Taobao anymore, they will go to Pinduoduo for that. So that created sort of a crisis situation. And we've also seen that at one point, and I think it might even have happened two times, that the Pinduoduo market value actually shot above Alibaba's, which was, of course, a bit of a loss of face. So what happened in, I think it was May last year, I think Jack Ma headed back to Hangzhou. I think he spends most of his time in Japan nowadays. And he got together with the management and he basically said three things. So we need to get back to the internet, we need to get back to the user, and we need to get back to Taobao. Get back to the internet basically means that we've been spending a lot of money investing in offline retail and trying to digitize that with Herma, with Fresh Hippo, or with RT Mart and other investments. We are basically an internet company and we should get back to our roots. Get back to Taobao means we need to get people back on Taobao, also back to our roots, not divert all of the traffic to Tmall, because that's what people are buying now. And the last thing is getting back to the user. Now, you can have a discussion about who the user is. Who the customer is. Normally, I've learned that the one who pays your invoices is your customer, but that's normally the brand, because they're a marketplace, they're a platform. So, but they also mean the consumer by that. And there's a couple of things that they have done. One of the things they realized, yes, we've not have enough assortment and offerings on Taobao. So we need to fix that. But we've also made it very complicated for customers. If there's the 618 festival or the Double 11 Singles Day festival, the way you get these discounts is almost like a mathematical problem that you need to solve. And there's all of these pre-sales, and you need to sign up on time to get an article that's maybe only shipped 3 weeks later. So it was getting far too complicated. And they said that we need to make that very basic again, like the basic discounts. So that's one of the things that they've done. And they've also looked a lot at what Pinduoduo is doing. We've, in episode one of this series, we've discussed how Pinduoduo has sort of a no return policy. The customer gets his money back, doesn't have to return stuff, and the manufacturer pays for that. They've also tried out that policy in the past couple of months, but they're sort of rolling that back because it's from certain perspectives very problematic, because people start abusing that system. And they didn't have that fully under control in the way that Pinduoduo had, because they also wanted to maintain a good relationship with the merchants. So, but overall, they are one of the things that they've changed is trying to be more customer focused than they've been in previous years through these kinds of changes. That
you mentioned something that I wanted to talk about next, which is Hema. Now, what does that phonetically translate to? It's not like Ulema, like, you know, you're hungry, yeah, which would actually make sense for a grocery arm of Alibaba. Do you know what Hema means?
Yeah. So if you look at the characters, it literally translates to box horse.
Okay. So it's the horse of Ma.
Yeah.
And Ma is always the example. We always use it. Just let me explain this. Ma, you know, this is the thing in Chinese. This is what frustrates people so much. So you can say Ma, but depending on how you say Ma, it could be five different things. You know, it can be cloth, it can be mother, it can be a scold word, it can be, as you said, it can horse. Be horse, yeah. Or it can just mean that's the question mark that you put at the end of anything you say to suddenly make somebody realize that you're asking a question versus just making a statement. And so we always use Ma. It's the typical kind of Mandarin 101 that you learn like within a few days of studying Mandarin that happens. So you have He and Ma, but the Ma in this case is horse. That's is interesting. Horse. But anyway,
and go ahead. The interesting thing is that these homophones, as they call them, the homophone in He Ma is actually the He. Because ge means box, and that is because box horse, which is probably a reference to the Kwai Di, the couriers that they used to have products home delivered. But gema with a different character for the ge is then gema becomes hippo. And that's why you see with the gema supermarkets of Alibaba, you see this character of the hippo just coming back into all of the branding that they do. So that's the idea behind the name.
I wonder how that would fly in America to have groceries associated with a hippo.
It's a very Chinese thing to do. I mean, all of these platforms also have like little animals as mascots, right?
Oh, I know. Yeah, they love it. Okay, that's awesome. So as we know through your content, Hema is you're quite interested in this little arm of Alibaba. Tell us a little bit more about it. Tell us why it's so interesting for you.
Well, I find Hema really interesting because it's one of the first concepts that was tried to take the online world and the offline world together, to connect them. Hema was really one of the first supermarkets where you can go there. You could also eat in a Hema. But the idea was that eventually you would just order in the app from home, make it very convenient, and they would deliver the stuff at your door. So this Hema was together launched with the terminology of new retail, which is a very problematic thing because it hasn't really brought what a lot of people expected it to bring. But it was a very tangible thing. So it was also something that during the study tours that we do, I could take people to and see and show them how the online and the offline world came together. So it was a very physical, tangible thing. At the same time, Gurma also became like an umbrella for more than 12 different experiments for retail formats, both for people with low budgets, but also for the middle class and upper middle class. So they tried out a lot of different things. So that also learns us a lot about what works and what doesn't work. And it also taught us a lot about the Alibaba culture, where innovation, they had so much money that whatever idea they would come up with, that Gurma, here's some budget, go and try it out. There's also maybe a bit of Schadenfreude, as they say in Germany, because you look at those things and you go, this is crazy. I mean, this cannot be possible that this is all going to be sustainable. And a lot of the stuff that I've written about Gurma is also about the things that completely failed. One of the reasons why I am fascinated by that and by doing this is because if you just follow the Alibaba PR, you're subscribed or to their Eliza Lau newsletter, you only get to hear the cool stuff when they launch initiatives. Nobody ever tells you what stuff failed. So that's one of the things that I like to write about. So what things went wrong with Gurma? What survived? What didn't survive? And how they are doing now? So that's why I frequently write about this specific topic for TechBoss China. Yeah, because also I think there's a lot we can learn, not necessarily copy to the West, but from thinking out of the box and looking at things from different angles. And see what the Chinese have already tried. Because a lot of the things that have already failed in China, you see some Western startups trying in the West. And most of the time, because of labor costs, it doesn't work. So, and we could have saved ourselves a lot of failures by maybe having paid attention to what's happening in China.
1,000%. Eleanor Roosevelt famously said, learn from the mistakes of others. We can't possibly live long enough to learn them all ourselves. That is the thing. It was always funny back in the day, a decade or more ago, where China was being challenged for having stolen so many ideas. And then through forcibly not allowing those originators to be a part of operating in China, they would just do it themselves and Groupon and Facebook. They all got kind of lumped into the same thing, but it was never really true. It was never really true. They were really just doing what everybody else has done for eons, which is just taking a good idea, but then localizing it so it fit into their market. And this is where people need to really kind of back off buying into the rhetoric that comes from Western media around how China operates, and actually put on a critical thinking hat and learn for yourself about how things actually work. And then, of course, now that it is happening so often and so much in the reverse, the wave has completely gone the other way. We don't necessarily hear any backlash against companies in the West that are completely copying maybe what China has done. And then, you know, a lot of lessons learned too, because I mean, China always has that kind of low cost of labor advantage, or used to have at least. But again, that is also slowly changing as well, or quickly changing, I guess. I'm so confused by, you know, having been in China for so long and the speed of how things happen in China. And then I come to the West and I'm like, oh, that's happening so slowly, where people in the West are like, are you kidding? It seems overnight. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess you're used to a different speed of things happening for sure. And you're familiar with Postmates from the US, which is that grocery delivery app, right? It's like, oh, I need some stuff from Walmart or Sobeys or whatever. You just go on the app, you know, they've got all the list of items, and you send somebody to go to Costco for you and then bring it all to you, versus like an Uber Eats. And so how does Gurma fit into putting those two models around it? Where does that kind of fit in there?
Yeah. So if you look at China, and I'm very fascinated in a topic of instant retail, which is one of the sectors in the e-commerce market that is growing fastest and is going to double in market size in the next 3 years. You have three models. Gurma is the store plus warehouse model, where you have a very nice supermarket, great products, high quality products, but you also have a warehouse connected to that, and you have an app connected to that, and you actually have people order picking. Staff is order picking in the store. They're putting this in these conveyor belt system under the ceiling that goes to the warehouse that's connected to the supermarket. All of the fast moving items are, of course, there because they're quicker and easier to pick, and it's delivered to you within, say, 30 to 60 minutes. So they have their own delivery service. And the second model is the front-end warehouse model, where you have a company like Dingdong Maizai, which does their own procurement and then has these sort of dark stores around the cities in places where, so they don't have stores that you're supposed to visit. What I normally tend to do is I just pretend to be a stupid tourist and I just walk into their warehouses just to see what they're doing. Because I'm basically doing research, and then I get kicked out, of course. But you're not supposed to go in there. But they will normally have like a small army of couriers also waiting in front of that dark store. People order online, and it gets delivered again. So that's a second model. The third model is more like a platform model, where you have JD Daojia, for instance, Meituan Shango. Erlema also does this, so several different companies that ask the retailer to upload, to basically put his assortment and his inventory into the app. And if you as a consumer look for a specific product, you see, oh, I can have that delivered not in 3 days from some central warehouse, but also within an hour, because there's a retailer selling that same product very close to me. And then, for instance, a JD Daojia will go and they will have the courier to go and pick that up in the store and bring it to you. Now, what I find interesting of that model is that it actually adds value, because instead of trying to compete with existing supermarkets and existing retailers, it gives them a certain package of services to help them digitize, put their assortment in an app, and also provide them with the couriers to bring that to the consumer. And that opens up a whole new market for them, because if you, for instance, a lot of convenience stores use this system in cooperation with Meituan or with JD Daojia, they normally have like 500 meters maybe that their customers live in. That's their service area. But if they can deliver, then that gets expanded to maybe 3 kilometers. And if this works very well, and even a company like Meituan says to these retailers, you know what, you can also create sort of your own dark store. And instead of having like 1,000 SKUs, you can have like 2,000 or 3,000 SKUs in there and sell much more products. So they help them help the retailer to set up these what they call lightning warehouses. So these are different types of models for instant retail. And Alibaba is just one model where they have a supermarket with catering inside and also their delivery service.
I don't know what it would cost to put in that type of infrastructure for existing supermarkets that have a monopoly and lobbying power to maintain market share. But to be able to go shopping, like, how many times, and I'm speaking to the audience too, how many times have you wanted to maybe go shopping on your lunch hour, but worry about the milk going bad or the ice cream melting in the car because it now has to sit there throughout the rest of your day? Wouldn't it be great to be able to bang out your shopping and then just walk out of the store carrying nothing, but then be able to have arranged to have everything delivered to your doorstep at 5 p.m. when you get home from work? I mean, just fantastic. I think the carrying and the boxing and the bagging and all of this, especially being able to get rid of a lot of waste potentially with just the bags and things like this, the whole thing, they could just arrive, unload a container or a big plastic box, a reusable kind of eco-friendly box, the whole thing, and probably good for the environment as well.
Yeah, and the thing is that for where we live, of course, that's very difficult. I mean, here in the Netherlands, for instance, we have a very densely populated country, but we live basically, most of us live in houses. Whereas in China, they all live in these enormous apartment buildings of 25 floors. So there's thousands and thousands of people living in what they call a xiaoqu, like sort of a compound. So the density inside the cities is extremely high, and the labor costs are very, very low. And it's not just the groceries, because I think that is still very difficult in the West because of the labor costs and that low population density. But it's also for non-food products. And I mean, if you, what you often see is if the newest iPhone launches, these instant retail companies have set it up in such a way that if you order it, they will deliver it from one of those lightning warehouses or a dark store or a retailer, and you have it within 40 minutes roughly. So, and those are of course also the products that have a margin that makes it feasible to have this type of direct delivery.
A margin and volume and the ability to, you know, get around on a scooter, you know, and you know, some of these things. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that play into that. Like you said, the compounds, the nature of compounds, the density of vehicles, vehicle ownership in China is still not anywhere near what it might be per capita in the West, and parking availability. And sometimes you gotta hike to get into your local Tesco, you know, in China as well. Like you're elevators and stairs and a whole trip through a mall kind of to get there. And so
plus the leisure time that people have available, right? I mean, in China, still a lot of companies have like these 996 work cultures where you work from 9 in the morning to 9 in the evening, 6 days a week. And then that bit of leisure time that you have left, you don't want to spend on order picking groceries yourself in the supermarket. You'd rather have that delivered.
Wouldn't AOV naturally significantly climb when you know you're not carrying and packing and lifting and traveling with you know, that's always a consideration. I think when you're shopping is a lot of those aspects of actually getting it into the fridge or the freezer or the cupboard. So it naturally kind of depresses maybe how much you would buy naturally. So you're going to see that go up significantly as well. Let's move on to Douyin. Let's just start again. Let's explain Douyin's success as an e-commerce platform in China.
So Douyin was one of the first short video platforms. I think they roughly started at the same time as Kuaishou. Mm. And the success basically is like we also I think discussed in the first episode, is that they have an algorithm which very quickly figures out what you like and serves you more of the same types of stuff, just like the Western version, TikTok, also does. So thereby it became very addictive. So they actually stole away a lot of eyeball time from Tencent. And that's one of the reasons why Tencent later started WeChat channels, to sort of claim some of that time back from Douyin. But Douyin was extremely successful in that. And of course, what you then do when you have this reach is you first start monetizing it through advertising, which they did. Then they started monetizing it through external links to e-commerce websites. So you would have, for instance, a small video about a specific product, and if you wanted to buy it, then you click on it and you get sent to JD or Alibaba or what have you. Then the next thing they did is they thought, well, hold on, we can also do this ourselves. Why are we sending this traffic to a different platform? So what we can do is we can have people sell that on Douyin. So that's where Douyin Shop came from, but it's TikTok Shop basically in the West, that people could in the app buy products. And then it's basically been expanding from there. So first you had e-commerce, then they started local services. The business that Meituan is normally in, where you can do group buying deals or you can book your hotel, even meal delivery, that also started to get integrated into Douyin. And now you even have Douyin Supermarket. So we discussed having home delivery from Hema. Douyin could be one of the channels, the distribution channels, where you could place that order. So from starting as a short video platform, it just basically grew into a new type of super app where you can do all kinds of purchases as well for both services and physical products.
Now I want to target some advice and conversation towards brands, a large subset of our audience, brand decision makers, brand owners looking to get into China. What would your advice be to a brand looking to launch a Douyin store?
That's a difficult one, because that's not primarily my, although my background is in marketing, that's not primarily the stuff that I research and write about.
Okay, disclaimer noted.
But the disclaimer noted. one of the things that I do notice about Douyin is some of the stuff is also like the same low price stuff that you will find on Taobao and on Pinduoduo. On the other hand, it is also a platform that can work very well for beauty care and healthcare and anything that is that you can link up with visual content. And then you have the content can be in two categories. Either you make short videos that advertise your product, or you have live streams. Now, live streams are also done on multiple platforms, and you could either have a live stream host, like an existing live stream host, and you could buy a time slot with them to promote, demonstrate, and promote your product. But what you see more and more nowadays also is branded live streams, where brands set up their own live stream instead of being dependent on an influencer to just maybe spend 2 minutes talking about your products, and you have to also pay a lot of money for that time slot, and you have to give a very high discount as well. Otherwise, they won't even talk about your product. So those are the two things that that you can do: the short videos and the live streams. And what I do see happening is that branded live streams get more and more popular, because also some of the Chinese consumers have a tendency of getting a bit fed up with big live streamers, especially the big names. There's been a couple of controversial situations and a couple of scandals with some of these live streamers. People also started to realize how much money they make. Li Jiaqi, who's known as the Lipstick King, scolded somebody online for saying, but when they said, well, this eyeliner is too expensive, he said something like, well, maybe you don't work hard enough.
Yeah, make otherwise, more money. Yeah.
You could afford it. So there is this shift taking place also in these big live streamers becoming less powerful and smaller live streamers gaining more traffic, but also, like I said, the brand store. So one of the things that a brand could do is try to create very interesting content and have their own live stream. And of course, then you need to also pay for the traffic to actually gain the traffic in an app like Douyin, because people need to come across your live stream where they're swiping. But that's one of the things that I can do. But again, I'm not an advertising expert that can give you like the big secrets of how to become successful with that, the right content.
Now, talking about Xiaohong Shu for a minute, and I think there's this belief, there's this kind of naive, I think, anticipation that once you gain attention, right, in the attention economy, once you've gained it, once you have critical mass of attention, you then sell that, you sell stuff to those eyeballs. Right? Does Xiaohong Shu carry any promise as an e-commerce marketplace on top of being a social channel?
It's very difficult with Xiaohong Shu, because they've been doing a lot in e-commerce, and they've also been growing in e-commerce, but they also have like a very delicate situation, because why do people go to Xiaohong Shu? Because people, Xiaohong Shu nowadays is almost like a search engine. My wife, if she has a question, she doesn't go to Baidu. She just searches for the answer on Xiaohong Shu, and there will be somebody that will have made an introduction video or even a picture post with text. So she normally nowadays finds her answers on Xiaohong Shu. So why is that? Because people have the feeling that it's like real people just giving honest advice and honest recommendations, not being paid by advertising. Now, at the same time, what Xiaohong Shu does have, they have a system where content creators can team up with brands and product owners. So by creating sort of tags and then talking about but that specific product. But I think that the users of Xiao Hongxiu are very sensitive to like honest, authentic advice. And if you start to push e-commerce more and too much, then it might actually damage what made the platform what it is. The difficult thing is that the question is then, how do you monetize a platform like Xiao Hongxiu? They've been growing a lot, but sometimes you see that if they push this envelope too much, then people start to complain about it and don't feel comfortable anymore. So this is sort of a dilemma that Xiao Hongxiu is in. So what therefore happens quite a lot is what they call grass growing in China, where you basically seed interest in a product on a platform like Xiao Hongxiu, but people end up and then buying it on a different platform, not on Xiao Hongxiu itself. So that's what a lot of brands, I think, are nowadays still doing. When Xiao Hongxiu doesn't have the optimal distribution platform for that, actually.
I mean, these walled gardens have been a part of China's digital landscape for almost two decades now. We talked about it a lot in the past when Baidu was really, really relevant, was somewhat quoted as the Google of China. It was, you know, the search engine. I still think it was the certainly the best mapping app for driving in China that I had ever used. It put Google Maps to shame when it came to driving, but I digress. People would search in order to make a purchase decision on Baidu. But unlike the Google-Amazon relationship, where Google would be paid or would get a cut for transferring that client straight to Amazon to make a purchase, you had to leave the Baidu environment and then autonomously go into the Alibaba environment in order to make the purchase. So you were getting informed, gaining an opinion and gaining trust and making a decision, a purchase decision on another platform, but you were not linked directly. Alibaba did not want to share revenue and data and whatnot with, they didn't want Baidu to know who was buying what and whatnot. And it was this very protectionist type of attitude. So this is nothing really all that new of what happens in China. So thank you very much for covering the Xiao Hongxiu, and we appreciate your opinions on things that you know are dabbling in, but maybe not a self-proclaimed expert in. So I appreciate that. I wanted to maybe tie this off talking about the local services war. I love this topic. I watch it with fascination. Talk to us about the local services war. First of all, what is local services? And then who's winning and why?
So local services is, as the name says, it's like any type of service that you can get locally close to where you live. So instead of like talking about e-commerce where a package could come from the other side of the country, this is something, either a product or a service that you can buy in your vicinity, nearby. And there's many different services. So you could talk about group buying. Just going into the Meituan app, which started off as sort of a Groupon clone, and you could buy a special deal to go and eat in a nearby restaurant. Or you could book a hotel for your holiday. You could have meal delivery, which is a big division in Meituan as well. You can have a rental bike. Simply scan the QR code of a bike and the lock opens, and you can use that, and you pay for the time that you use one of those bikes. You see them, especially in the first and the second tier cities in China. So these are all things that that Meituan does. Then you have Didi, which is basically like the Chinese Uber. As a matter of fact, they bought Uber China, which is a ride-hailing app. Meal delivery is also sort of overlapping with local services. Now, the big players in these kinds of things are, on the one hand, is Meituan. Like I said, which started out as a Groupon clone, but just kept on building. So they also have community group buying. They have the bikes. They have what else do they have? They have the meal delivery. Then you have Erlamer, which started out as a meal delivery company, but they are now also doing a lot of instant retail that we are talking about. They're one of those platforms where you can buy from any shop near you. So Erlamer, Meituan, and what always happens in China is that different companies don't stay like in their own little space. They, especially if they have a certain
nobody stays momentum, in their lane.
Nobody stays in their own lane. And like I said with Douyin, which started out as a video app but then started to do e-commerce, so became a competitor to JD and Alibaba, Pinduoduo. Then they started to also sell group buying deals and hotel bookings, etc. So they also started local services. So this has been happening in Douyin. So you had Erlamer and you had Meituan, and then all of a sudden there's a Douyin that does some of the same stuff. So continuously new competitors are popping up. Now, one of the question is, who is winning? I think that Meituan is still leading in the local services business, but it has become much more difficult with these new companies also joining that same space. What it also does, it changes the things that are happening in the app. Because, for instance, on Douyin, it is a short video app. So if you want to sell a group deal, it's most of the time it's done by a live stream or by a short video. And that meant that to really advertise their offerings, these retailers or hotels or restaurants also needed to start creating content. Now, most of the time, they couldn't do that themselves. So they actually had to get somebody, an influencer with a camera or maybe a whole crew, to create that content for them. So it's created also a whole new business of content creation for local services. Now, when that started happening, Meituan had to do the same thing. So Meituan, because of the pressure from Douyin, also had to start video content. So they also teamed up with content creators so they could say to a merchant, like for instance a restaurant, okay, we can refer you to a team that can make that content for you. So local services started to get that video component. But what it has also done, it has created more costs for the merchant, for those, for instance, restaurants. Because now they need to hire a camera crew to make that content for them. And they still also need to pay the commission to the platform when they make a sale. So it actually, this competition between these platforms quite often makes it harder for the person that is using those platforms to sell their goods or services on. So that's mostly the development that we've seen in the past couple of years. People getting out of their own lane, creating more competition, but also for the merchant, more costs by doing that.
I know probably somewhere around a year ago, we discussed on the show how Meituan was going to be very difficult to unseat as number one, and in large part due to just their army of foot soldiers that were just lining up all the opportunities for customers and app users. And that was simply going to be something that gave them an advantage due to the cost prohibitive nature of being able to line that up and challenge the lead that Meituan had already. Would you say that here we are maybe a year, year and a half later from that conversation, that has changed?
No, I think it's still the case. And I also think that's one of the reasons why sometimes you see that when you in areas where you don't need so many foot soldiers, and especially, for instance, in food delivery, where you have the couriers, you need the couriers to actually drive the meal to the consumer. Douyin has also tried that local service, but has not been very successful in that, has not made that targets because they don't have that army of food delivery quite yet. So they need to team up with third parties. Like, for instance, you can buy your meal on Douyin, but they will either the restaurant will have to hire his own courier to bring that to you, or it has to be done through a third-party platform like Erlamer. So, for instance, Douyin teamed up with Erlamer to take care of the delivery. But then, of course, that adds like an extra layer. And there's two companies that need to make a margin, or three companies that need to make a margin on that. So it doesn't help the cost price, which resulted in Douyin mainly selling like big value deals like McDonald's for the whole family, not like small meals, because that's the only way that they could still make a margin on this kind of business. So I think Meituan is unbeaten in that, although in some of the business like restaurants and hotels, Douyin has done quite well, but has not beaten Meituan as far as market share is concerned.
Repeat for everybody still with us here at the end of the podcast, how to get in touch with you to get on that trip to China. Where do they go to learn more about that and get in touch with you for that one?
So from the 20th of October until the 26th, so like a full 1 week, we are doing a tour, TechBus China, that I write for and that people can also subscribe to for this kind of information. TechBus China is teaming up with Kaiser Kuo of the Seneca podcast, and we're doing a 1 week tour with the theme of China's breakneck modernization. And people can find more information on chinatechtrip.com/Seneca. All of the information is there, and the registration is open until September 1st.
So we either race to get in on that trip, I understand that there's a few spots left, or hell, just get on the waiting list for the next one. I cannot recommend something like this enough, and this is completely unbiased, but you're talking about getting a chance to go with two of the best people that could possibly take you there that are as connected as anybody could be. You know, like I said in part one, Kaiser was with Baidu for years. He has a absolute storied history with China, and he knows just about everything and everyone you could possibly know. So you know that this trip is going to be epic and super informational filled, and knowing Kaiser, probably going to be a lot of fun too. He's an epic person to be around. Yeah. So you'll get introduced to everything and probably enjoy your share of Baijiu as well. Ed Sander, leading analyst of China's digital technology scene, thank you very, very much for being on the show. We really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For everybody who's listening to the podcast, don't forget to go check out the WPIC YouTube channel to catch more of like the YouTube shorts and some of the more the video content in short form over there, as well as the long form versions of these podcasts. And for those of you watching on the YouTube channel, go check out the podcast if you need to go driving or biking or something else somewhere. But from me and for Ed and from everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.